Hello and welcome back to Lower Decks, a Star Trek podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman, and this test is not fair.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland, and I am a lot more like Commander Riker than I would like to admit.
I think that is true. I think that is very true.
I mean, I'm actually fine admitting it, but the joke worked better the other way.
All right. Well, we are here today to talk about Lower Decks, which is the 15th episode of Season 7 of Star Trek The Next Generation. This episode aired on February 7th, 1994.
It was written by Renee Echevarria from a story by Ron Wilkerson and Jean-Louise Mathias. And it was directed by Gabrielle Beaumont.
Well, this is our first episode in about 6 months, but we did promise that we would be back from time to time, and this time we are back because a very generous, really awesome Patreon supporter commissioned this bonus episode. We're super grateful for that support, also really grateful for the opportunity to cover the episode that is the namesake of the show, but this commission is especially cool because it is a birthday present for the friend of the person who ordered it, so we also want to say happy birthday.
As a special birthday treat to the dear person in our commissioner's life, I am going to attempt to say happy birthday in Klingon. I failed like out of the prerequisite for the Klingon on Duolingo. Did you know this, Glenn, that on the Duolingo language app, you can try Klingon? They tried to teach me vowel sounds and I failed so miserably, I quit. Have you ever tried?
And just for context, you actually have a PhD in a foreign language. So,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know several foreign languages. None of them are foreign languages that sound anything like Klingon.
Well, let's hear it.
So I'm going to mess this up. And also, I saw that there are some alternatives, but I think it's Koshilj Dativjaj.
Yeah.
So I tried to bring some passion to that. Happy birthday, I think, or maybe I just insulted you, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, you may have just started a war, actually, but I probably would have just gone with live long and prosper, and so I will. I'll just say live long and prosper.
Well, let the record show that one of us took the easy way out.
All right. Well, let's turn our attention here to the episode Lower Decks, which is famous for being the episode of The Next Generation that is not told from the perspective of the bridge crew. Instead, it is told from the perspective of four junior officers, and this is taking place during the quarterly crew evaluations, and so we get to see their anxieties about their careers, but we do also get to see what their lives are like. We get a glimpse of how members of the bridge crew, by which I mean our regular cast, are perceived by others on the ship. There is a plot to this episode. It's actually a fairly serious plot, which we'll get to in a few minutes. But I just want to talk about the gimmick of this episode before we get into any specifics. Just in general, Valerie, do you like this sort of story?
I love the conceit of this episode, and I think it's really fun. I think it's why Red Shirts worked so well as a parody novel for listeners that have heard our coverage of that or read that themselves, just to kind of laugh a little bit at the preposterousness of the premise that we're only following a certain people and that so many other things need to get done on the ship in order for it to run. And there are all these other rich lives that we don't get to see. It's why I think Lower Decks, the show, is so successful. So I love it. I think I will say that in my head, this episode lives as, oh, that really fun one where we get a different perspective. And then every time I watch it, I get 5 minutes into it. I'm like, wait a second, this episode's really sad.
Yeah. Yeah. You suddenly remember, oh, right. Someone's going to die a horrifying death.
Yeah. It's like not a silly, it's like it is silly fun, but it's also so totally not silly fun. And I have some other thoughts on that in general, but as a conceit, I'm in.
Yeah, me too. This is one of my favorite gimmicks in, well, largely speculative fiction shows that we get this. There's a really great episode of Babylon 5 that follows some custodians around for an episode that's excellent. The Zeppo episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer is just absolutely one of my favorites, just a delightful episode. And I love Lower Decks as well. But like you, in my memory, it's always this fun and lighthearted episode. And then I also forget that actually it's quite a serious episode and we have some serious topics to talk about. But before we get there, let's actually just talk about the four Lower Decks characters here, this group of friends who like to drink together in 10 Forward.
Nurse Ogawa will probably be the most familiar character among the Lower Decks crew that we are following in this episode. She's appeared throughout, I think, all 7 seasons. I'm not sure if she was in season 1. She's been on TNG for a while.
Yeah, she's been there long enough to feel like she was in season 1, even if she actually wasn't. She also appears in commercials for Star Trek, I think famously. I don't know, it's not famous, but I remember it from my own youth, was in a Hallmark commercial for a Star Trek ornament.
I'm sorry, what? Do we have this footage?
It probably does exist, yeah.
I mean, she's been here a long time. She was in Inner Light. That's something that you might like about her. She was in Man of the People. That's something we might not like about her. but yeah, she's a familiar character. And from what I understand, the writers felt that they really enjoyed her as a character and as an actress and wanted to give her more to do. And that she wasn't originally going to be part of the Lower Decks crew centered upon in this episode. They were worried they had too much going on and too many stories to follow, but they enjoyed her character so much that they included her here. I also didn't know this, that they had asked Suzy Shimizu, who is did something with the budgets on the show, to name the character. They wanted the character to be Japanese. I think they named the character first name after Susie's daughter and last name after her maiden name. So that's kind of sweet. And you see that in like the sweetness and the gentleness of Nurse Ogawa. Just to anyone who hasn't watched TNG in a while, she is Beverly Crusher's number one, I guess, main nurse assistant in sick bay. And we get to see her relationship with Dr. Crusher play out in a very warm and loving and supportive way throughout the course of this episode. She's also going to Dr. Crusher for relationship advice. She's dating and ends up engaged to somebody else on the Enterprise crew. And in general, she's just very sweet and a total delight.
Yeah, and she's really kind of an anchor for us because we have seen her in all these other episodes. And the next character on the list is Cito Jaxa, and she's really the central character of the episode. We'll talk more about that when we get to doing a bit of a plot synopsis. But she also is a character that we already know, though only a little bit. But we did meet Cito in the 5th season episode, The First Duty, which is the one about Wesley at the Academy. And the plot there is that Wesley and his friends in Nova Squadron were practicing a piloting maneuver, a maneuver that is forbidden at the Academy because it is too dangerous, and a member of the squadron died in a horrible accident. Wesley and the others, and in fact, this includes Tom Paris before he was Tom Paris, they cover up the cause of the accident, but Geordi and Data and Picard uncover the truth. So now it is 3 years later, and Cito is on board the Enterprise, and she is trying to do better. And at this point of the episode, she is part of Worf's security team, and she's getting trained at tactical, but Worf has recommended her for a position at ops, and taking that position at ops, that's where Data normally sits, that would require a promotion, and so the crew evaluations actually matter to her right now. I should also mention that Cito is Bajoran, because that's going to matter to the plot.
Next up on our main Lower Decks cast is the Vulcan ensign, Torek. Gosh, how to describe Torek? I mean, very Vulcan. Really has the Vulcan like look about him. I think the actor is nailing Vulcan-ness very well. And something that is very, like, he seems kind of able to make jokes and be a bit sarcastic with his Vulcanness among a largely human and non-Vulcan crew, but is the standard Vulcan we come to know and love. Honest, very sincere, very straight-faced. And what I think is interesting about following him through this episode is that we get to see him get on Geordi's nerves a little bit, but in the explicitly because he's not picking up on smaller social cues from Geordi, like Geordi saying, sure, I'd love to hear your ideas anytime. And he's like, OK, yeah, I have a lot of ideas now. And Geordi's like, I didn't mean that. But of course, a Vulcan would just take somebody at their word. But you see him kind of bugging Geordi. I think Geordi maybe sees him as overeager or a little arrogant because he has a lot of knowledge about the warp nacelles that he would like to share and he has ideas for improvements. But I think fundamentally he's just a very sincere character who has suggestions and wants to make the ship go better.
Yeah, he comes off as very sweet, I think.
Yeah, what's hard for me about watching Torik, so I was reading a little bit about this, I didn't know it. So one, this actor is Jerry Taylor's son. Did you know that?
I did, yeah. So this is the second connection where, you know, people behind the camera of the show are having something to do with the appearance of these characters on scene, right? We've got Ogawa's name, and then here we have, yeah, the son of one of the writers and producers of TNG, but also especially of Voyager, getting to cast her son in this role.
And another thing that I didn't know is there was a lot of background concern, because this was, there aren't really Vulcans on The Next Generation, and I think he was maybe one of the first ones at all, or who was going to take up a lot of space on the show. And there was a lot of concern that he would just be too similar to Spock and that people would be upset about that. And the actor has spoken about feeling really in between a rock and a hard place because he didn't want to be exactly like Spock, but there had been there was recently a Vulcan on Deep Space Nine who was criticized for not being enough like Spock. So they were trying to toe a line there, though I don't, like, all we want is for more people to be like Spock. So I don't know why this was ever a concern. But his name was originally supposed to be Sorek, and they thought it was too similar, and they wanted to match. They're doing all this T naming with Vulcans now, so they wanted to match that. So they changed the name to Torik, which is even more confusing because the same actor plays a different Vulcan character on Star Trek Voyager whose name is Vorik. And it is really, I cannot separate the two of them, especially because Vorik has a quite violent Ponfar in a Voyager episode that I can't unsee.
Yeah, that's the episode Blood Fever, which we talked about, I think, when we did our ranking the engineers episode at PhilCon, because it's really a B'Elanna Torres episode. But yeah, they came up with the idea of Vorik, of course, after this episode, because Voyager hasn't started yet at this point. And it's certainly in my headcanon, and I think it is in the headcanon of a lot of fans, that in fact, Torik and Vorik are twin brothers.
Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense with the naming.
The naming does seem to indicate that this is the joke that the writers had as well, though I don't know that anyone has ever officially said that, but it lives in my brain.
I mean, I'm just interested about the family dynamics there, because, like, Spock was given so much hell for joining Starfleet. Can you imagine if you had two 100% Vulcan kids and they both chose to join Starfleet?
I think at this point, probably that stigma is over, though, right? Because, you know, because Spock's father and his generation predate the Federation. But I think now we're, you know, a century later, that there are more Vulcans who have been born since the Federation has come into existence. And so take for granted that it's there and that this is the institution you might want to join if you're interested in space exploration. So I bet that's a stigma that has fallen by the wayside. Certainly there are, you know, multiple Vulcans on board the Voyager. There's at least this one here on the Enterprise now, and we get to see Vulcans in Deep Space Nine too.
Fair enough.
All right. Well, the last of the four junior officers that we need to talk about is Sam Lavelle. He's another human. In fact, his grandfather was Canadian. This seems to really matter to the plot. Well, not the plot, but a scene anyway. So Lavelle wears red, which means that someday he would like to command a starship. But right now, he's been working at the helm. And the three characters that we've talked about so far, right, each of them has been paired up with a member of, well, not, I guess not the bridge crew, but the main cast, right, with Dr. Crusher, with Geordi, or with Worf. And Lavelle gets paired up here really with Riker. And Lavelle's deal is that he feels like Riker is being especially hard on him, and he keeps responding by trying to get Riker's attention and show off, which of course just serves to irritate Riker even more. Now, Lavelle is also up for this promotion and move to ops, and it is really just him and Sito who are being considered for the job, which then means that these two friends are competing for it in some sense. And Riker's irritation at Lavelle, and maybe even really just just a dislike of Lavelle, I guess, is a topic of conversation between Riker and Troy at a poker game that we get to see later in the episode. And Troy actually sticks up for Lavelle by comparing him to a young Will Riker. And so Riker then agrees to give him a chance. But I wondered, Valerie, how you felt about this, how you feel about Lavelle's eagerness to please. Would you have given him a chance here, or would this have taken him out of the running for the promotion if you were in charge of that?
Well, first of all, you bring up a good point, is that you are properly situating each character you talk about within the episode, which I am failing to do. So, right, Nurse Ogawa is in sick bay wearing blue. Sito is in security wearing yellow. Torek is in engineering wearing gold, also yellow, gold, green. It's different from yellow, I guess.
Yeah, we do actually call it gold, but I guess it is. Yes, I guess it is technically gold, though, to be honest, I always just think of it as yellow.
Right, because Cito's in yellow, too, and that's security. Anyway, and Lavelle is in red. What do I think about this? First of all, I love the editing of the scene where the junior officers and the senior officers are both playing poker and they're having these conversations. And sometimes like the camera will then switch to a conversation with the junior officers and then in the middle of it, without us knowing, into a conversation with the senior officers. And I thought it was really fun and heartwarming. And I took it largely to be like, you know, these relationships form early on and they're really special and like these characters are going to grow and have the opportunity to kind of replace these other ones. And thinking of the family of TNG continuing is a really nice thing. I think Troy is absolutely right. And I think I found Riker to be quite arrogant and rude in this episode in a way that felt a little uncharacteristic. One of the things that I didn't like about this episode is, in a weird way, it's kind of like a military hierarchy episode, right? There's a lot about commanding officers and relationships with superiors in a way that feels hierarchical to what I would like Starfleet to be, which is a very collaborative and cooperative and non-hierarchical and, you know, celebrating everyone at every stage kind of organization. And this comes back to like, is it a military or not, right? And I think in this episode, it's very much a military. And I thought Riker was acting out the hierarchy-based negative version of that the most in a way that I didn't enjoy.
Yeah, I had this real sense that Riker agrees with Troy here in the comparison between him and Lavelle. I mean, he explicitly says he doesn't think that, but I think internally he does. I think that's actually why Lavelle irritates him. It's like looking in a mirror,
yeah,
right?
For sure. Yes, Troy is right. And Riker, I think Riker knows that Troy is right, but I don't think he really realized it before that moment.
I agree. Yeah, I think this was a cathartic moment here where he had not realized what it was about Lavelle that just rubbed him the wrong way from the start. And I, you know, as I have gotten older, have been in situations like that as well. And it's nice when people point out to you that you're doing that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny though. It's hard. It is a little bit hard to get behind Lavelle, you know, like a little, I don't know. Is he smarmy?
Yeah. To make the comparison visceral to us, the viewers, they needed to cast someone and indirect that person they've casted to make us think like, to make us feel that this character is Riker-esque, Riker-like in some way. And the decision, I guess, was to go for the flirt, I guess, but it came off more sleazy than charming, unfortunately.
Yeah, maybe like a cheeky smile.
but not enough eye twinkle.
But not enough. I don't know. Well, look, I am famous for liking beardless Riker, and I was about to say, but he doesn't have a beard. So I don't know. I'm all over the place.
Who are you?
Who even am I? But I think they did a good job in that Lavelle really carries kind of the air that Riker carries himself with. And Riker would be that brazen and a little bit out of line. And that's what Picard loves about him and all that stuff. So yeah, I'm glad Troy pointed that out, and that I wish that Riker had. It seemed a little out of character for me that Riker wouldn't be like, do you want to sit down and chat when Lavelle came over for a beer? So
right. But that's the whole deal with they're in the middle of crew evaluations and Riker's got a pad out. So he's clearly working and doing a task that he really doesn't want to do.
Yeah, the whole thing about them not liking doing the crew evaluations is a little strange, too. Like, they're taking... I understand that as we get, right, farther along in our careers and we're the ones, like, making these decisions, we understand... they start to feel less heavy to us. But I thought it was an interesting choice to present these two pretty serious and devoted officers, Troy and Riker, as not invested in the futures of the people that they command, which is a huge contrast to how Worf feels about Sito. Worf is invested in the way that I would kind of expect a Starfleet officer to be invested. I also do not understand why they're doing these crew evaluations in 10 forward. That feels like a huge confidentiality issue.
Yes, I actually have, from this episode, a lot of questions about 10 forward at all. Like, why there's not a separate senior officer, junior officer, like bars, like why they don't have separate bars for this reason, but other reasons as well. We can talk more about that later. But yeah, in defense of Riker and Troy and their attitude about this, I mean, this seems like a huge amount of paperwork that they have to do quarterly. My goodness, quarterly. Like, this sort of thing, considering promotions and so on, that to me, that seems like that ought to be an annual type of review. I mean, you know, when I was in the American military, which is slightly different from the Federation military, but not that dissimilar, we had quarterly evaluations, of course, but there was one, you know, annual evaluation that was the big deal. And yeah, it seems just like Riker is maybe a little tired of the paperwork. They've got other things going on. And Troy must, you know, she's got a full schedule too. Yeah, it struck me as strange that they're the only two people involved in this for every single person, for ensigns, which is not how the military I was in ran. Someone at Riker and Troy's level wouldn't have been doing the evaluations for someone at the ensign level. So it just seems like they're overworked is what I'm saying.
Right. I mean, look, not wanting to do it and wanting to do it in the bar, like, makes sense if you're working a little too hard. But again, in Starfleet, labor is equitably distributed and people aren't overworked, right? This is like, they're interfering a little bit with my utopia.
Yeah, I do think that the whole gimmick here, the setup of them at the bar, right, where it's clearly evening because Troy is being asked, is, you know, kind of a joke about whether or not she wants dessert. They get coffee instead of drinks. It's clear that they have been at this all day, that the task is, you know, maybe even taking longer than it ought to because they've actually been doing the evaluation so diligently for the, I don't know, 800 that they did before they got to the ones that they're talking about as the episode opens.
That is fair. And but if we are situated in the bar, we do have one more character to talk about.
Yeah, tell us about Ben.
So Ben is our, I guess, bartender's assistant. Guinan is not in this episode either, which I think is part of the conceit of Lower Decks, right? That I guess she's the head bartender. So we're not going to see a lot of her here. I don't think we've seen Ben before. And I'm just going to read a little bit about how he was described in the script, because I think it maps out onto his character really well. Ben has an easy smile and wit. He signed aboard a starship for fun and adventure, and as a civilian, isn't subject to the pressures of Starfleet. He likes nothing more than to kid his friends about how seriously they take everything. So Ben is kind of our go-between, or quite literally our go-between. Because he's not in Starfleet, I think he's kind of supposed to be in his maybe early or mid-20s, young, happy, friendly, knows everybody because he works at the bar. He can hang out with the senior officers and he's not afraid of them. He's not afraid to approach them and chat with them, but he can also be friends with the people who are more his peers, the junior officers. And he is waiting on Troy and Riker as they do the evaluation. So he comes over to say, to give the news that Lavelle and Sito are up for the same job. So he's kind of providing the gossip. And we see him later in the episode playing both poker games. He plays with the junior officers and the senior officers. And it was cool. I don't think we really knew, other than like the families, like spouses and children, that there were civilians on the ship. I guess maybe I assumed... I guess Guinan's a civilian. I didn't really think about that. Like, is the hairdresser a civilian?
Yes, I think the hairdresser is a civilian as well. And I think there are perhaps a handful of other civilians on board the ship who may not necessarily be, you know, the partners of military personnel on the ship. So like there's school teachers and that sort of thing. And I have to say, Ben has the job that I want. Like, that's the job
I
want.
Yeah, that we both want.
Yeah. So, you know, you're on the ship, but you're a civilian. You actually work in the bar, but you're not even in charge of the bar. You just make drinks for people when they come in. And then when it's, you know, your off time is your off time. And presumably you get a chance at the holodeck, you know, once a month too. And then when you've got R&R, you know, cool planets, you get to go, you know, vacation, get to see things, explore. I mean, it's just, it's the life.
Actually, I take it back. I don't think I want to be Ben. I think I want to be Guinan, and you want to be
I do not want to be in charge of anything. That's what I'm saying here. Yeah. No responsibility, please.
I want to be in charge of it, but also I'm Guinan, so I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I was a little saddened that we didn't actually see Guinan in this episode the way that we see the senior person for all these other characters. We don't get a scene with Ben and Guinan. That's the one thing I think that I felt was missing here.
Well, we've given it haphazardly already, but how about in one good go? Glenn, would you like to give us a plot synopsis? Like, we've kind of referenced, we're assuming maybe listeners have seen it, but let's tie it up neatly. What is going on in this episode?
Yeah, there is actually a plot for these characters, though the plot really is mostly for Sito, and then to a much lesser extent, really, for Nurse Ogawa and for Torek. And the deal is that the Enterprise is hanging out at the Cardassian border because they need to get a Federation agent. It's a Cardassian who is a Federation agent, I should say. And they need to get him back into Cardassian space. The plan is to make it look like this Cardassian is a bounty hunter who had gone after a Bajoran terrorist and been captured by the Federation and then escaped with a Federation shuttlecraft. Now, to make this more believable, Sito, who is Bajoran, is going along to play the role of this Bajoran terrorist. And the idea is that once the Cardassian, and this Cardassian's name is Jorette, so the idea is that once Jorette is past the border patrols, he's going to jettison Sito in an escape pod, and the Enterprise will pick her up. But the escape pod never shows up, and when the Enterprise looks a bit deeper into Cardassian space, they find the wreckage, because it's been destroyed, and Sito has been killed. And this was pretty tough. I mean, I think you start to see this coming as the plot comes to fruition, but still, I thought the very end of this episode was pretty heartbreaking. And, you know, watching this episode multiple times, I mean, over the course of my life, of course, but then especially for this episode, I started to wonder, Valerie, whether or not Jorette actually killed Sito, right? I think the explanation that we're kind of left with is that it's the Cardassian border patrols must have destroyed this escape pod, but I'm not so sure of that anymore.
One of the things that Jorette says, you know, Sito directly asks him, why are you doing this? Why are you helping the Federation? Why are you spying, you know, against your own people? And his explanation isn't that he loves Bajorans or feels guilt about what Cardassians have done to them in the occupation. His explanation is that he loves Cardassia and he thinks it's going in the wrong direction, which is, you know, when we are made to be sympathetic to Garak, that's what we see too, right? Whenever Garak seems like he's pro-Federation, he's actually just pro-Cardassia in a different way than other Cardassians. So given that information, do you think that Jorette is like maliciously killed her to protect himself? What's your thought about how that would have happened if that's what you believe?
Yeah, I don't think this was like some kind of hate crime or something like that. I do think that Jorette really is a Federation agent and really believes all of the things that he says about his agenda, his interest in curbing warfare, because the warfare is wrapped up in political factionalism. That seems to be what he wants to do away with. So no, my feeling that Jorette did this on purpose, the scenario, I guess, that I have in mind is that he's being challenged by the border patrol and, you know, he is going to get back into Cardassian space and resume his life. That's his goal. And in order to demonstrate his bona fides in some way, I think he perhaps stages Sito trying to escape from him and launches the escape pod and blows it up in order to prove his bona fides to the Border Patrol, to prove that he's not smuggling a Federation agent in. But I think the big reason that I started thinking that is this one line that he says when he meets Sito. He says, "I didn't think she would be so young." And it really made me think that this was his plan all along, or at least he knew that there was a chance that this was something he was going to have to do.
I'll just come out and say I disagree. I don't think it's infeasible, but it's not how I'm reading the episode. I think my view was that Jarrett knew there was a likelihood she might be killed by the Cardassians that do a check on his ship. And given that, he felt pretty horrified at the idea of how young she was, because everybody in the room understands she might die. And I think they all understand that from the perspective of the other Cardassians might kill her. So I think it's highly believable that that either, you know, he did eject the escape pod after the routine check. I guess something that is maybe a little fishy is that they find the remains of the escape pod, not like of the ship or something. So he's already ejected it, which means they probably passed their routine check. But to me, it's pretty feasible that another patrol could have come by, seen it, and destroyed it, or that maybe Jarrett couldn't get the timing right and messed it up somehow. So I really don't think that he did it. I guess if push comes to shove, I could see him doing it if he had to in order to survive and continue serving as an agent for the Federation. But I think it was just a tragic set of bad coincidences.
Yeah, I guess I had trouble understanding why another Cardassian ship, a Border Patrol ship, would destroy an escape pod that has no weapons, right? No ability to do anything to the ship. Why they wouldn't, you know, they scan it for life signs, they see there's a Bajoran in there, and why they don't pick it up. And now they have a prisoner to interrogate, right? And so that was where I started thinking that Jarrett must have killed her so that she couldn't be questioned. Either to prove his bona fides or because they were going to be boarded. Like the Border Patrol didn't buy his story. And so he had to make sure that she couldn't give him up. You know, having confidence in his own ability to lie and bluff and explain, but not being able to trust her, who clearly is going to be able to be identified as an ensign in Starfleet, right? So yeah, I want to agree with you because I also think that the episode wants me to agree with you, but the details just made me really suspicious, and I just had this real sinister vibe from him this time.
I think that's just what Cardassians look like, right? I mean, they're always sinister in a way. And I think he is really sinister. I think one of the scariest parts of the episode for me is the answer he gave about why he's doing this, because he is fundamentally asking her to risk her life. And he's not saying, I'm sorry about what we did to your people, right? Like, she says, oh, I never thought a Cardassian would say that, as if it was like a really kind response or something. But to me, it was super cold. And if I were her, I would have been a little freaked out for a variety of reasons. Would have been a lot of bit freaked out. But I still don't think he did it. But I agree with you, there are some curiosities in the plot.
Well, the point of the episode is not to put Jarrett on trial, of course, but I did get kind of obsessed with it. But let's talk about what really is the emotional core of this story, which is Sito. It's about her redemption following her part in the death of Josh Albert, and of course, her part in covering up the cause of that death. Part of the story here that I left out of the synopsis is that Picard gives her a pretty serious dressing down about her role in all of that. It turns out later that that was all a test to see if she would stand up for herself. And this was part of how Picard was determining whether she was ready for this type of mission, this secret mission. And I did enjoy getting to see Picard in his deeply disappointed and mildly angry dad mode. That actually really appealed to me. But I am not sure that I cared for this as a leadership move. How did you feel about this ruse?
I thought it was really sad. I couldn't stop thinking about how if Worf hadn't pushed her a little bit and she hadn't figured it out, that she just would have lived with thinking he thought that about her. That felt like such a risk to me, like such an unkind thing to do, and potentially have someone then live with for the rest of their career. I thought it read manipulative to me. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't, unlike you, I didn't enjoy Picard in this mode. And I don't know. I guess psychological tests are a thing that happen in the military sometimes. But I wonder if a conversation just could have been had.
Yeah, it to me, it seems even counterproductive. I never experienced anything like this in the military. We've never seen Picard do anything like this before. He's almost always, you know, forthright, especially with his crew, when he's in leadership mode, when he's in mentor mode, which is clearly a position that a role that he sees himself in here with Sito. We get that clearly in the next installment in this, the next beat in this. So yeah, I just wasn't even sure that this was the best way to go about assessing her readiness or fitness for this mission.
I also think one of the big ways that it's manipulative that the episode doesn't really address is that even though, yeah, there's some resolution, she realizes it's a test, she comes back, she stands up for herself. There is no way that being yelled at like that by Picard about something that you carry deep shame for doesn't have a lasting effect on you, even if some of it is reversed or healed a little bit. And I have to imagine that a part of her felt like she had to sacrifice herself to make up for what she had done, that it was a huge influence on her decision to join this mission, that she had to prove her dedication and wanting to be different than she had been in the past. And it was literally life or death. And that didn't quite feel fair.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, because this then puts all the pressure on her to say yes to an assignment that is ostensibly voluntary, though then she's also forced to agree to it or not before she's given any of the details. So this seems like just it's a really bad shake for anybody here, and just doesn't actually strike me as Picard's general style.
No, I think she was given, Worf gives her the opportunity to say no after she knows everything. And it's strange because I think Worf is acting the way I would want a Starfleet officer to act, more so than Riker, more so than Picard. And normally Worf is not the person in that role.
Right. In fact, really, yes, thinking about the org chart of the ship, Picard is the captain. He's the captain of the ship, and he's in charge of the missions of carrying out Starfleet's orders. Riker is in charge of the personnel on the ship as the XO, the executive officer. So Riker really should have been the one to be taking up for Sito and taking her aside and doing these sorts of things with her. Worf is her department head, though, so he also would be doing those things. So I think that fits nicely. But yeah, even just the dressing down in general, that the fact that came from Picard, where it's really Riker's role to interact with crew, especially junior crew like that. I guess, the thing was a test. It was a ruse, right? It was outside of normal, standard operating procedure, I should say. But yes, this was one of the rare times actually where I wasn't sure that I wanted to be in this command.
Yeah, and I wonder if what we're supposed to take out of this episode is that maybe our beloved characters aren't so beloved. I don't know, but it's not what I wanted out of the episode.
Well, and I think it's really just this one scene, and maybe not even in the moment of that scene. It's perhaps more when we realize that it's a ruse. But then, we do get the second beat of this, which Picard explains that he did handpick, right? He selected Sito to come to the Enterprise to make sure that she actually does get a genuinely fair chance, that this mark on her record because of the death of Josh Albert and the conspiracy to cover up the cause of that death doesn't actually haunt her at her first assignment and, subsequent assignments after that. He wants to make sure that she really gets a chance at redemption. And that's, that's the Picard that I'm here for sure. And I don't think you had a chance to watch the first episode with Sito, did you?
I didn't, but I do remember it. I don't remember, deeply as much as if I had recently rewatched it, but that episode definitely is one of the ones that stands out in my memory.
Yeah, I did. Elizabeth and I had a chance to watch the first duty again, so that it's fresh in my mind. And something that stands out actually in putting the two episodes together that I think is easily overlooked in the first duty is that there is an allusion to some backstory from Picard's own time at the Academy when he did something that got him in trouble, and that he also needed to be given an opportunity for redemption. He also needed Boothby the Gardener's help in coming clean and in confessing to his crime or admitting that he did something wrong. We don't know any of the details, so I'm not quite sure which verbs and nouns to use there necessarily. And so this really seems like this is Picard in a leadership position decades later, looking back at his own experiences and realizing that he wouldn't be where he is now if other people hadn't given him a chance, and him wanting to do the same thing for other people, right? To give people a chance at redemption. And so definitely all of this is a beat in this episode in the Cito story, but these scenes also actually feel like the second and third beat in a Picard story that we get when we put these two episodes together. And that's a type of attentive, serialized storytelling that TNG does really well, and that I really love when they're so careful about thinking through Picard and the little arcs that he gets to have, the little emotional arcs he gets to have. I thought that was spectacular.
What season is The Last Duty in? Do you know?
That's it. That's in season 5.
Okay, so it was quite a while ago. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but that does make the episode even more rich and explain why Picard might be bringing an intensity to this. Of course, you know, as much as Picard doesn't want to admit it and TNG doesn't want us to really show it, Picard really cares about Wesley. And Wesley is a central kind of disappointing figure in that episode too. So given how much he cares about Wesley, he's going to have even more personal attachment to the story than somebody who just heard this story about cadets who, you know, they didn't know very well. But I will also say one thing that they're doing too is they're pairing Picard and Cito as versions of each other, the same way maybe they're pairing Lavelle and Riker as versions of each other. They're certainly doing this with Ogawa and Crusher as versions of each other. I don't think Geordi and Torek are versions of each other, but it's interesting to see that theme carried through.
Yes, it's an interesting choice actually to pair Torek up with Geordi there rather than Data, given, right, that Data as an android is really TNG's version of Spock as a Vulcan. It's an interesting choice that they didn't pair them up. But I had not thought about Cito and Picard as being paired up simply because, you know, she's with Worf for all of these private moments and he's clearly her immediate mentor. But no, absolutely, you're right. I think Picard has a demonstrably vested interest in Cito. He knows who she is, you know, on first sight, right? Which he's not going to know that for every junior officer. And, you know, he might know things about them from their files and so on, but to know them in the hallway or the turbo lift and so on seems unlikely to me. And so, yeah, he's clearly invested in her and maybe has high hopes for and high expectations of her. And also because she is, as you say, a kind of stand-in for Wesley, right? Picard couldn't get Wesley back on the Enterprise. That just is total nepotism at this point. But he could do for Cito what he really wanted to do for Wesley. And so she's kind of a stand-in there.
And the pairings that I was mentioning were more like people who see themselves in the younger officer. Right. So I think Picard sees himself in Cito, as you mentioned, and that Riker sees himself in Lavelle, and that Crusher sees herself in Ogawa. Don't think Geordi sees himself in Torek.
No, no.
And I don't think Worf sees himself in Cito.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Well, speaking of Worf, I've got one last question that I want to pitch to you, Valerie, and it's about the end, right? At the very end of this episode, we see the friends of Cito, so Ogawa, Torek and Lavelle and Ben as well, I guess to a lesser extent. They're in 10 forward, they're having a drink, and they are grieving for Cito. And Worf is there too, but he is drinking alone and staring out the window. And in the end, he goes and joins these junior officers at their table. This is at Ben's behest. I wonder, do you think that was the right choice? Was that a good idea for Worf to go join these grieving junior officers?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't really have much more to say. Why wouldn't it be a good choice?
He's their boss.
So?
So that's going to change their behavior and their ability to actually like be open and honest with each other and to remember their friend when your boss is around. I would not want him, if I were there, if I were Torek or Lavelle, you know, or Ogawa, I would not want Worf to come over to that table. I would have wanted him to stay away.
Oh, interesting. I thought it was such a beautiful gesture. I mean, I think maybe what I'm hearing in your answer is that like this is their only time to grieve. They'll have time to grieve privately and without Worf. Worf won't always be there. But in this moment, you know, Worf really cared about her and they really cared too. And they're feeling really lost. And I think they need someone to turn to and to take, you know, to feel confidence in or authority in as just kind of like a guidepost, right? Something to level them a little bit in this hard moment. And I also think grief is something best processed. I mean, everybody's going to have their individual process of grief, and that's really necessary. And I want everybody here to be able to have that. I think they will. But I think collective grieving is so important. I think it would have been a little bit weird if he didn't acknowledge that he lost someone too. And I like the idea of being able to break down rank for a moment and just be humans in the moment of loss.
Yeah, I think I would have found this totally uncomfortable, especially given, you know, I did say that Worf is their boss, which is true only in the sense that he outranks them. It's actually extremely unlikely that he's ever spoken to any of these people before. Well, I guess probably Nurse Ogawa, because he gets hurt sometimes and has to go to sick bay. But otherwise, probably has not spoken to Torek or to Lavelle before at all, because he's not really directly in their chain of command. So in terms of Worf participating in group grieving about Sito, that's something that he should have actually been coordinating within his own department, right? The people who actually worked directly with Sito. I mean, I have questions, I guess, about how Sito is even friends with all these other people who they don't actually work together and so on, but I'll leave those questions aside. But I just, but that would have struck me as the more appropriate thing. Yeah, this felt wildly inappropriate to me.
That's just really not how I saw it. I think it's weird that we're so on such opposite ends of the spectrum here, but I didn't see it as inappropriate. You know, we don't see him sit down and we like, tell me everything and, da, 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 and try to direct it or use his influence. Like, he's very vulnerable in this moment too. And, you know, when we lose someone, if we go to some sort of grief ritual to mourn or celebrate them, we're largely doing that with people we've never met before, but we are connected in a very important way with people who were all connected to the person that was lost. And there's something really powerful and beautiful about that. So I don't know. I thought it was a beautiful gesture. And it's not going to be all, like I said, it's not going to be all the time. Worf won't always be there, but just like on the day of the news, I thought it was beautiful and supportive and human, I guess, humanoid, let's say, to not have a human-centric universe since there are Vulcans and Klingons at the table.
Yeah, I will not quote Star Trek VI to you, but only because I can't get it verbatim right now off the off the cuff. But yeah, I think this episode actually left me really feeling uncomfortable with the existence of 10 Forward at all, as a bar for everyone, as opposed to having distinct places for senior officers versus junior officers versus enlisted who don't actually seem to exist in Starfleet at all, so that people can be around, you know, can be in their own peer group and can be relaxing, having a drink at the bar without the scrutiny of their bosses and vice versa, I suppose, as well, right? It's a place. One of the things that we get in this episode is that Ben calls Riker by his first name. He calls him Will because, hey, Ben's a civilian. And when Riker comes in here, he wants to be treated like a civilian. You would not do that in front of your subordinates, though. That's just that would not actually happen. I don't think. But we don't really have a space for that on the ship, which I used to not spend a lot of time thinking about. But for some reason, this immersion in the episode this time really had me thinking about that.
I just think we're coming at it from really different perspectives, because this is something I didn't like about the episode, the ways in which, like I said, it separates and ranks and creates power dynamics that separate, that like keep people apart. I love that 10 Forward exists as a neutral space where everybody just gets to be themselves. And, you know, maybe there are some social lines you don't necessarily always go sit down with your commanding officer, but like that you can see, oh, that person's a human, that person's a human. Like, we're all peers here. We're all humans who need to relax at the end of the day and maintain our friendships and look out the night space window. I think it deconstructs the hierarchies, and I like thinking of Starfleet, as I've said in the episode, as a place where, you know, everybody just gets along. Isn't that the whole point? I love precisely the thing you don't like about it.
Well, we still have a little bit of business to do before we close this episode out, Valerie. And it's been a while, I think, since we've had actually such a big disagreement, which I really love. But I want to move into some more fun and games bits here. And I think that you have already tipped your hand here, but did you have a favorite line or scene or moment?
This is so strange because I don't love Worf. Especially because I can't unsee his axe on Ryza in the future of Deep Space Nine. But I think my favorite scene was actually the Geek-Tal scene with Worf and Sito, where he's just like, "You did not anticipate," and he just keeps saying that. And I don't know, because you just see a more tender side of him. And I think that was probably my favorite part of the episode, which is not what I expected myself to say.
No, it's not what I expected you to say either. You raved earlier about the poker scene montage, so I thought that that was what you were going to deploy here, which was most definitely my favorite scene, was this extended montage we get of the senior officers playing their poker game and the junior officers playing their poker game and essentially having the exact same conversation, such that we cut back and forth where characters in different scenes are responding to each other or finishing each other's sentences. And I thought that was just really brilliant storytelling. And it really emphasized the extent to which these junior officers, these lower decks characters, are really the next generation, so to speak.
Well, I have a fun and games question for you, Glenn, which is, which character do you think should get a spin-off show? And I will say, I think we're going to agree. So should we 3, 2, 1, then name the character?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. 3, 2, 1, Ben.
Ogawa.
What?
I knew you were going to say
you
Ben.
You waited. I knew you were going to say Ben. You made me go first.
So Ben is the character I want to be, but I don't actually want to follow that show, at least not as much as the show that I'm going to pitch to you, which is that I actually want an Ogawa show, because what I really want is Star Trek ER.
Is George Clooney there?
Absolutely. Yes, please. That's exactly what I want. At least the occasional guest appearance. But yeah, the whole business with Ogawa and her relationship with Crusher, like their, you know, the nurse doctor relationship, the being involved in each other's private lives and so on. I mean, that's an entire genre of television that we have, the medical dramas about, you know, the relationships of doctors and nurses and so on, and what it is to be in a hospital. And we just have never had a Star Trek show that's just that. And I would like to have a Star Trek medical show.
You're right. I think that would be really fun. I would definitely watch that show. I think what's cool about Ben is if there was a Ben show, it would basically be like taking the conceit of Lower Decks, the show, a step further of like, we're going to see Starfleet from a different perspective, and one where nobody's neurotic or taking it seriously, right? Like, Ben is just really an outside observer to this whole world, and we don't get a lot of Star Trek stories that are not about Starfleet members.
Yeah, I definitely would like to see a type of Ben show, maybe in line with the short treks that we've been getting with the newer Star Trek, a sort of 20-minute vignettes that all center on Ben making videos about how to make certain cocktails, but then the procedures are always interrupted by some kind of, you know, adventure happening. I would watch that series.
Well, if we're going to be watching it, should we be drinking something?
Yes. And in fact, I have made a cocktail for this episode. When we first meet the four friends, the four Lower Decks characters, or really, I should say, the four junior officers, because I don't want to leave Ben out of this, actually, though Ben presumably made the drink. But at any rate, they are drinking a pink cocktail. Each of them has the same pink cocktail. They're in 10 Forward. And We have some watermelon in the house right now because Finch loves it and will eat really an entire watermelon, actually, if you let him. I saved some, actually, from his guzzling munching of watermelons the other day to make a pink cocktail here in honor of these friends. And so what you're going to do here is muddle some watermelon. I really recommend a whole wedge. So you cut the fruit of the wedge into smaller chunks. You put them into a cocktail shaker. You use a muddler or really anything that you have around that can work as a muddler to just, you know, smoosh up the watermelon, get that juice out. And then you're going to add on top of that 2 parts gin, then 2 parts elderflower liqueur. My preference is Saint-Germain, but there's lots of elderflower liqueurs out there. Add some ice, shake it up, and pour it into really the glass of your choice. I should say that this is a lot of ounces of liquid. It's not all that boozy. It's less boozy than a standard martini, for sure. But it is a lot of liquid, which means it's actually perfect for making in batches to share with your friends. And if you're inclined, you can have a toast to the friends who are absent as well.
This sounds delicious. I love a watermelon drink in the summer. I want to say Finch would love it too, but I guess that's weird. He's a child.
He's a child. Yeah, we're not gonna let him have it. Also, I think he just wants to eat the whole watermelon. I think he might even just kind of want to burrow into a watermelon at this point.
Well, who doesn't? That sounds lovely.
That's fair. It's a good question.
It is kind of like a womb, I guess.
Well, this is the point where the episode got weird.
It definitely is.
Well, I think it might have been earlier, but it's well, I think on that note, then, that is going to do it for this episode. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Valerie Hoagland. Thank you so much to our commissioner today and for letting us put out an episode that is our namesake. Maybe it was rude of me to criticize it at all, but I'm really glad we got to do it. And to our other listener, our commissioner's friend, another happy birthday. I will not be repeating the Klingon.
Well, I will say live long and prosper one more time, still avoiding saying the Klingon, but yes, sincerely, truly, happy birthday. And thank you so much for the commission. Lower Decks is, well, it's one of our favorite episodes. It's the reason why we chose Lower Decks as the name of the entire podcast long before we knew there was ever going to be an entire show taking their cue from this episode. And what a joy it was for me to get to watch it multiple times this week, get to watch it with my wife, Elizabeth, and to talk with you about it, Valerie. Just a real joy for me. So I'm so, so grateful for that.
And until we're back to cover Star Trek ER, stay spacey.